Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Governor Kathy Hochul joins us now with details of what she says is a conceptual agreement on the new state budget that could have massive implications for affordable housing in New York State and a lot of other things. We have about 10 minutes with the governor today. So, Governor Hochul, always good of you to come on with us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Looking forward to our conversation.
Couple of things about housing. To start, all I've seen so far is this language like preliminary agreement and conceptual agreement. So can you give us any specifics, first of all, of the so-called good cause eviction rent increase limits or the tax breaks that developers could get as part of a deal for building how much affordable housing?
Well, Brian, as you mentioned, this is still a conceptual agreement. All those specific details will be out, you know, within a matter of days, I believe. But what that does is when I had that press conference, it signals that there is a handshake deal between myself, the Speaker of the Assembly, and the Majority Leader of the Senate, that we're prepared to have them go back to their conferences and then bring to us, you know, we'll settle on the final details. So all that will be out there. But I will say, we realize, and everyone talks about this shortage of housing crisis and the fact that New York City has a 1.4% vacancy rate, I knew the only way out, and economists know the only way out, is to build more housing. And ultimately, the larger the housing supply you have, the better it is for tenants because it starts driving down the prices, which right now are high because there's a shortage of supply. So there's a lot of initiatives in there. We have incentives for the developers to build because when that lapsed a couple of years ago, literally they stopped building, 85% decline. So that means affordable housing units weren't even on the books. They just walked away from them. So I'm trying to jumpstart that again. Also, you know, using office space. Why is it so difficult to look at a building in Midtown, for example, that's only, you know, half full or a third full since the pandemic and say, why can't people live in Midtown and be able to have a 24/7 right. lifestyle here, not far right. from their work? So, but also, tenants have always been important to me. And this is the most significant changes for our tenants that they have seen. We worked really hard to find anti-gouging measures to limit what landlords could charge them. And I believe, again, of course, there's always questions, there's always controversy. Everybody wants what they think is the perfect deal, but this is so much more than they had, and I think I would take that as a win.
Well, tenant advocates like Housing Justice for All and the Met Council for Housing are saying good cause eviction provisions were gutted so much from the original versions that they don't really protect tenants very much from eviction or heinous rent increases if they're not already in rent-stabilized homes. Get as specific as you can to argue that tenants should be happier than that about this.
Oh, of course they should be. And again, I know how passionate these advocates are about their cause. I understand that. But I've been in elective office for 30 years, and what I know is that compromise is not a dirty word. It does not mean that you're selling out. To get your foot in the door, to do something that the legislature right. with these advocates support has not done till now, because I'm not sure they have the votes, Brian, because otherwise this would have been on my desk before. This was the only path.
So what's
that gets
the something
over the finish
that
line.
What's the something that they're going to get?
We're going to be protecting tenants from massive rent increases. And so that is significant. That is what the biggest complaint has been, that they're being driven out of their homes. You cannot just raise rents on someone and drive them out of their home. There are limits. 5% is all you can raise it on plus CPI. And that's not what the status quo is right now. And that is a win. But getting back to the fact that the whole focus is to build more so tenants don't have to deal with such outrageously high prices right now. And that's what the ultimate goal of this is.
although progressives were unhappy with the old tax break for developing new apartment building system because they saw it as giving taxpayer subsidies to for-profit developers for too little actual affordable housing. So can you get specific at all about why this would be better in that respect? Are there higher percentages, 50%, 75% of units that would have to be substantially below market rates, anything like that?
All I would say is that under that program that was started in the 1970s, 421A, to really be a catalyst at a time when New York City was really in decline and nobody wanted to build there, this was an incentive that says developers, if you make 25% of your building affordable, we'll give you incentives, because otherwise what the landlords or their property owners are doing right now, they're taking that those building lots they have and the space they have, they're doing expensive condos and co-ops. So that is what has happened in the last 2 years since this expired. When they are building and there's not much building going on, they're not focused, they will not do any affordable building, affordable housing, and if it's not in their interest. So all we did was just two things here, Brian. We expanded the existing language for 6 years because a lot of projects weren't able to be finished while that tax break was in place. But we also said, we're going for a new model of this. We call it 485X. And what that does is, and the labor unions are very pleased, that the hardworking men and women of New York City will have a shot to be building the new houses of the future. So they did not have a place before. This was negotiated since last summer. We brought all the players together. And if you ask the leaders of the labor unions, the building trades, they're delighted that they'll be able to have their workers building these projects because there is public dollars involved.
But you're saying 25% below market rate is the most you could get.
Yes, because if it doesn't pencil out, if it doesn't make financial sense for the developer, I can't force them to build. I can't say, no, you must build here, because it is their property, and what they're doing is building condos and co-ops with it instead. So you have to find that sweet spot, and that's why this was so hard fought for between everyone. And we had to work with, the legislators and work with the industry to say, we want to make sure that, you're not, that you have restraints on what you can do. Also very much aware that this is ultimately to help the tenants. But if we don't, we need the tax incentives to jumpstart new construction. We also have affordability. If we leave it on its own, all we're going to get is new construction with zero affordable. 25% is better than zero.
One more housing item that we've been reporting on is making legal and bringing up to code basement apartments with housing for new immigrants, badly needed and often used with basement apartments, and after the flooding of out-of-code basement apartments after Hurricane Ida. Advocates are concerned, again, that the original proposal is being very watered down. Can you tell us if there's a basement apartments provision in the budget and specifically how extensive it is?
Sure. And I walked, and I was a brand new governor for about a week when Hurricane Ida hit. I walked those streets in Queens. I saw what happened and places and homes where people were flooded and literally drowned in their own home because they were trapped in those illegal basement apartments. That was one of the reasons I said we must bring them into code. We want places for people to live. It's often very affordable. It helps a homeowner be able to make some more money to pay their mortgage. And as you mentioned, it's a home for our migrant community where we're struggling to get them out of the shelters where they are now and get them into real homes. But what we have to do is also be sensitive to what communities want. And what you'll see when this is unveiled, all the details, we have to make sure that there's local involvement, the assembly members and the council members who represent a district, because some neighborhoods really want this, some do not. And so we don't want Albany to always be dictating exactly what's going to happen at the street level. So you'll see a compromise that allows for it to happen on a pilot basis. But just as a note, this is one of the reasons places in California, Los Angeles, and others are starting to crawl out of their affordability and their housing crisis because they're finding creative ways where there's been barriers before, like ADUs and accessory dwelling units and basement apartments, which I think made sense in most areas, but again, sensitive to what the local communities want. But we need to get people into safe housing, no doubt about it.
I know our time is very limited. I want to try to touch two other items very briefly. One is mayoral control of New York City public schools. I read that you reinserted it into the budget process rather than let it wait for later in the year. And advocates want some strings attached, including that the mayor will comply with a smaller class size law that's already been passed. Are you going to include a smaller class size requirement on the mayor?
I will say this. I propose this in my budget to get it done during the budget process so we can have the certainty for our children and our teachers and our principals to know what's going to happen. So I focus on the kids, and people often will criticize this way to do it, but I'm saying I want to get this done so we can get focused on what's most important. And we brought together City Hall, the legislature, education advocates, and labor, and I will assure you that what ends up being, you know, enacted, if we get, you know, I feel confident, but again, it's not 100% done right now. I feel confident that it'll meet those needs and make sure that the law we passed 2 years ago that deals with class sizes, I signed that into law. That was something that happened under my first year as governor, that is being adhered to. That's very important. And the mayor knows that. And, you know, we're structuring a very complex deal here. But I think ultimately, again, is everybody happy? Never. Right. That's not the world we live in. You know that. But compromise is important. And I think we'll get to a good place.
That sounds like a yes on smaller class sizes. And the last thing is something that the mayor's been asking you for and even asking President Biden for, what he calls a decompression strategy on all the asylum seekers coming to New York City. And as you know, by decompression, he means he wants you to say, no, you can't all be in New York City. It's too much of a burden on one city. We're going to have some of you in the Capital District. We're going to have some of you in the Rochester area. We're going to have some of you in Westchester. Are you giving them anything on decompression?
We have migrants in all those cities you mentioned, Brian. They have already been going there. In fact, the state has a program where we will pay for accommodations for migrants who go upstate for a year if they once they have their work authorization. And I have to tell you this, I'm surprised at how few have taken advantage of it. We can't force them to leave the city. They came here, and now there's already communities being established. Someone, just like all migrant communities, you know, whether they're coming from China or India, people come here, someone plants the flag, they start building a sense of community, and they start getting jobs, they start finding housing, and they share housing with the next group coming in. And that's what's starting to happen with the individuals who have been literally coming for the last 2 years now. So they have options to go elsewhere. Many are turning it down, but those who have, you know, they're being welcomed. Again, not 100% of the state, but it's working out well. We also, put $2.4 billion into support what the mayor is doing, $500 million more than even last year. So I don't know that he even expected that. Everybody always wants to ask for more. I ask for more out of Washington always. I know how that's done. But ultimately, Brian, this will be solved if the Republicans that we have in the state of New York, 10 Republican members of Congress, will walk into Speaker Johnson's office and say, we will support your reelection or your position as Speaker only if you take up what the Senate did, a bipartisan negotiated by Democrats and Republicans bill to address the border crisis, more border control agents, more enforcement, more support decompression at the border and help us at our northern border and money for cities like New York. And they'd walked away only for one reason. Donald Trump told them to, because they did not want Democrats or President Biden to look like they could solve this problem. So that's a frustrating part for us. I'm working hand in hand with the mayor because this should not fall on his shoulders alone. And that's why we've been supporting it. Last year we did $1.9 billion. We're paying for all the shelters you see that is fully funded by the state on Randall's Island and Creedmoor and Floyd Bennett Field. I have over 2,100 National Guard, totally paid for by the state. We're picking up their health care costs. I don't think people realize the scale of what we're already doing. But again, it's the point is we are at capacity. We want to make sure those who are here get the work permits they need so they can enter the legal economy and not be abused by employers in the underground, which worries me a lot. And make sure that they have the shot that other people came here, like my very poor Irish immigrants did, you know, two generations ago.
Yeah. I'm going to let you go after some bit of breaking news here that maybe you can explain. Apparently, I'm seeing that there was some kind of cyber attack on the bill drafting system up there. What happened, as far as you know, and is it going to delay the budget?
No, it's okay right now. Well, we have to go back to the more antiquated system we had in place from 1994. This happened, very, very early in the morning, and so we've been on top of this. I have one of the top cybersecurity teams in the entire country. I knew that was a priority, so no one will do it better than we do in trying to get to the bottom of this attack. But our understanding right now is it'll take a little bit longer to deal with the legislative side of it because a lot of data is included in the computers, and we need to do what they call bill drafting, and then the printing, and then the passage. So so the agreements, I would say, are in good shape, obviously, if we're doing drafting and printing. That's, a message about how far we've come along. But we're finding the path forward using 1974 computers that we still have access to.
74 or 94, right?
94.
Yeah,
still,
so that means
eternity ago.
A couple of more days on the actual bills and the actual vote?
I can't tell you that right now because we've been, we're more concerned about, finding the source, finding how we can remedy this, how we can just get back to normal. So it's something we've been dealing with since the wee hours of the morning.
Was this a politically motivated attack?
I don't know. I won't be able to answer that. We'll let people know what we know when we know it, but right now we just have to solve the problem.
Governor Kathy Hochul, we always appreciate when you come on the show. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it very much. Bye-bye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and joining us now is our Albany correspondent, John Campbell, to discuss what we just heard from Governor Hochul, because he's much more in the weeds, much more familiar with the details and implications of what we just heard than I am. Hi, John. Thanks for listening to that interview and coming on right after.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Well, what about that cyber attack, first of all? Did you learn anything?
That has been the buzz all morning at the Capitol, and I'm so glad you asked about it because that was news from the governor there. I mean, she said they're going back to some sort of system from 1994. We're going to have to figure out some more details on that. But, I mean, yeah, obviously that is having some sort of effect here, particularly because they were just getting to the point where they might start printing bills to actually vote on. And that's a big part of the budget process to actually get it done. And now we have this cyber attack that we're trying to learn more about. And yeah, it sounds like they're going to have to go to some sort of backup system there, as the governor just confirmed.
She didn't know or wouldn't say if it was a politically motivated cyber attack. Are you hearing anything from any sources that somebody or some group was trying to delay the budget printing process, to delay the vote on the final budget for some political purpose or something else?
No, I mean, we have very few details about what actually is going on here, aside from the fact that there was an attack and what the governor just told us. So, yeah, that is what we're trying to figure out here. I mean, I haven't heard any inkling that it was politically motivated or something like that. But we live in a world right now where cyber attacks are very, very common, and, malware attacks and locking people out of their systems for ransom. And I don't know if any of that is what's going on right now, but that is, we've seen that in other government agencies throughout the state, throughout the country, throughout the world.
All right. We'll blame Russia until we hear otherwise. No, I'm kidding. listeners, we can take some phone calls for our Albany correspondent, John Campbell. Your reactions to anything you heard from Governor Hochul or any questions that you have to help clarify anything that you just heard from Governor Hochul, 212-433-WNYC. You can call or text 212-433-9692. Okay, John, on housing, the big ticket item of big ticket items, translate what we just heard on who's getting what that they wanted in terms of rent and eviction protections. If the governor gave us any specifics, you heard me trying to get her to get more specific than she wanted to get.
Yeah, and she did get more specific than she did the other day when she announced this, what she called the parameters of a conceptual agreement, which immediately goes in my Albany glossary of terms, because that was a pretty good one, I thought. But, it is the one thing that was interesting that she said. She did confirm that one measure of the good cause eviction bill is that, you know, the reasonable rent would be considered 5% more than the rate of inflation. That is what we had been hearing, that, you know, it's not exactly a cap on rent increases, but it is basically it gives tenants an opportunity to challenge a rent increase greater than that in housing court. So what we had been hearing is 5% greater than the rate of inflation or 10%, basically whichever is lower. So what the governor said lined up with what we had been hearing, but it was nice to hear confirm it. And, you know, that is, but the big question still is, what exactly are those exemptions going to look for? What kind of tenants are going to be exempted from this good cause eviction program? And that's really the big thing here that you know, we're going to be combing through the budget legislation, however they end up printing it, to try to figure out.
We have a good cause eviction question coming from a caller, Jason in Queens. You're on WNYC with our Albany reporter, John Campbell. Hi, Jason.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yeah. So what did you get from the governor by listening to that?
Well, I feel like I got a lot of hot air, to be quite frank with you. I had some questions about the 2019 rollbacks that were now going to be put into effect because of this new budget. I mean, something like 1 million of rent-stabilized households in New York are going to be raised by almost $200 a month per unit, right? And so people like myself and people like my great-grandmother, who actually I brought out to canvass for Governor Hochul, right, soon won't be able to afford our homes here in Queens that we've been living in for years.
This has to do with renovations and the amount that they could raise the rent after they do certain renovations on an apartment, Jason?
Say that again?
This has to do with how much landlords could raise the rent under the deal that may be emerging after they do renovations on a particular apartment. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. Rent-stabilized apartments in particular.
Oh, rent-stabilized apartments. John, anything on that?
Yeah, that's what they call the IAIs, the individual apartment improvements, and that is part of this housing deal in some form or fashion, although we don't, you know, like so many of these things, you know, we have details based on what lawmakers are telling us that they've been briefed on or what lobbyists have been told by lawmakers. So, you know, there is some wiggle room here before the final legislation is printed, but what we've heard on that is that they are nearing a deal, or part of this housing deal will be to allow landlords to pass off a greater amount of improvements to apartments to their tenants in rent stabilized units. And, you know, as of now, it's capped at something like $90 a month that they can pass those off on the rent regulated tenants. It would move up to maybe a couple $100 a month. The overall cap would increase, but we don't have the exact details on that yet. And that's one of the things that has been under debate in Albany for months now, and really, really under debate for the last couple weeks.
One of the things that might have been more specific that I did get out of the governor than I think she has said before is giving a number on the percentage of below market rate or affordable units that would be required for developers to get tax breaks for building new apartment buildings. And she said 25%. So 75% could be at market rate. 25% would have to be at below market rate. I know tenant advocates want a lot more than that. You know, they say it still gentrifies the neighborhood rather than makes it more affordable overall if you're adding 75% new market rate apartments. And I asked, 25% is the best you could do? And she said, yeah, that was the best she could do. Was that new to you?
Yeah, that was new. And that lines up with what we had heard from lawmakers. And that would be a slight bump from the old system, but it, you know, still relatively in line. The other thing that we have heard that they're looking at doing is reducing, basically making those quote unquote affordable units actually more affordable, making them affordable to a lower income rate than was required under the previous system. But that is, you know, again, this is, I feel like I'm saying it over and over again, but, you know, nothing is final until we see it in a bill. Right. And we have not seen anything in a bill yet. Yeah. And that's what we're waiting on cyber attack.
Do you think it could come, the cyber attack aside, that 25% could include percentages that are specified in the law for people making under X income and under Y income? You know what I mean? So there are carve outs for not just middle class, a little less than market rate, but really lower income people who desperately need more units.
Yeah, it's based on the area median income, and the number that has been tossed around recently is 80% of the area median income, but we don't know specifically if that's, you know, if that's going to be final or not. But yeah, it's all based on the area median income, and then what level of rent they are deemed to be able to afford.
And what's the area? I know we're getting into the weeds here, but if you define the area for the median income as the whole New York City metro area, let's say, that's going to be a lot higher, allowing higher rents, than if you define the area as a particular low-income neighborhood of the city that needs a lot of really deeply affordable units.
Yeah, it is more targeted than just the New York City metro area. So, you know, the Manhattan would have a different AMI than, you know, outer Queens, outer Brooklyn, something like that. But, I don't know off the top of my head if it is by zip code or if there's some other regional metric there. But it is definitely more targeted than greater New York City area.
All right. We also talked with the governor about mayoral control of public schools and a possible requirement for smaller class sizes in exchange for extending mayoral control. And Kaiser in Brooklyn has a question about that, I think. Kaiser, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I'm a teacher and a parent. I was really frustrated and disappointed with the governor's response on that. I feel like the NYSED report was really clear that mayoral control disenfranchises students and parents and teachers. And I don't really understand why the governor pushed so hard to include it in the budget. And the fact that the compromise was that the mayor has to follow the class size law, which was already a law, seems really hollow to me. And I'm wondering, whether there's any chance that there'll be some impactful reforms considered, like restructuring the panel for educational policy. But from what she said earlier, it seems like there's not much of a chance.
And we'll get John's response in a minute. But what system would you like to see, Kaiser? Because when mayoral control was first instituted under Mayor Michael Bloomberg, you know, over 20 years ago, a lot of the reason was that when there was more local control, when there were 32 local school districts, it was like 32 little fiefdoms and nobody was really accountable. And so Mayor Adams to this day calls it not mayoral control, but a mayoral accountability provision. What would you like to see?
Yeah, well, sadly, I don't think anyone is really accountable right now. The mayor kind of has a rubber stamp with the PEP to do whatever he wants. And the NYSED report pointed out, there's no proof that anything is improving under mayoral control. I think, it's a complicated public school system. And so the result is going to be a complicated system, but it's not either or. It doesn't have to be 32 distinct districts versus mayoral control. It's a large system, so one ruler of the whole thing really doesn't make sense. And I think we can look to cities like Chicago that have transitioned away really thoughtfully from mayoral control. And there's a lot of public comment in the NYSED report that give really clear ideas of how that can look, with stakeholder input, where elected parent leaders who have a proven track record of leadership for equity have more of a say. Right now, you know, leaders come to the panel for educational policy and speak for hours really powerfully about the changes we want to see, and the panel completely ignores us every time.
What's a really very top change that you would want to see that if parents were more empowered, you think might be more possible?
It's hard to pick just one. I think the over-policing of students of color is up there for sure. having meaningful restorative justice systems in our schools instead of right now. We've gone away from some of the punitive policies, but there's no restorative justice infrastructure in place to replace it. That's something we need really desperately.
Kaiser, thank you very much for your call. John, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm glad the caller brought up the panel for educational progress, because that is actually something, I know the governor didn't mention it when she was talking there, but that is something that is under discussion here in these closed door negotiations, to the best that we can tell. And maybe a different makeup there. I mean, the mayor does have, I believe it's a majority of appointees on that, and maybe he gets less, or maybe he doesn't appoint the chair, or maybe there's some sort of oversight of the chair he appoints. That is one of the things that lawmakers are trying to discuss. And, you know, the governor mentioned, this is the first time that she actually talked about this, but she mentioned that, you know, she brought together labor and the mayor's office and legislators, and that seems to be what has happened here, that UFT, the United Federation of Teachers Union, is at the table negotiating changes with the mayor's office, and that seems to have what brought this back onto the radar screen. And on the class sizes thing, the caller was right in saying that 2 years ago, lawmakers did pass a cap on class sizes in New York City. That was part of the deal to extend mayoral control for 2 years. And that's, you know, kindergarten through third grade eventually will be capped at 20 students, high school classes, 25 students. What they're trying to negotiate, what lawmakers are now trying to negotiate under the budget, is some sort of enforcement mechanism. Maybe you tie New York City's increase in state funding to ensuring that the school funding is used on implementing that class size mandate. Those are the kind of things that they're trying to tie to this extension of mayoral control.
John Campbell, WNYC's Albany correspondent, thanks for hanging around after Governor Hochul's interview and helping debrief and interpret what we heard from the governor. Very interesting stuff. And we'll see what happens with that cyber attack, too, and if they figure out who did it and how long it's going to delay the actual printing of and voting on all these budget provisions. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Today on the show, if the world situation seems complicated right now, David Sanger from the New York Times has a way to explain it. His new book is called New Cold Wars, and it's his take on how we got from the end of the old Cold War around 1990 to where we are today. In 1990, if you've lived long enough, you know, most Western leaders thought the future would be global democracy and global economic growth. They thought Russia was done with empire building when the Soviet Union collapsed, that China mostly wanted to integrate with the West through free trade that would lift all boats, that the emerging new thing called the internet would democratize information and therefore make authoritarianism harder to maintain, and that even the Israelis and Palestinians would realize that their forever war was benefiting neither of them and figure out a way to coexist. But where are we today? Information and disinformation chaos online, right? The resurgence of nationalism and authoritarianism on every continent. Global trade seen as a failure for the middle class, at least in this country, and a growing alliance between Putin, Xi Jinping, and the leaders of Iran. The old Cold War is over, but the new world order that the West thought would emerge is instead giving way to what David Sanger calls new Cold Wars. And the 21st century version of the question, how much will leaders everywhere have the wisdom and restraint to keep them from getting nuclear hot? David Sanger coming up with that big think analysis and to take your calls later in the show. Also, your calls on who you track on your phone and who tracks you, right? Parents and teenagers, spouses and lovers, old college roommates, maybe even work colleagues. This is for you. Where's the line between safety and surveillance? When does closeness become creepiness, when you can always see exactly where the people in your life are or when they can see you? But we'll start with a more local and granular and everyday kind of turf war than the ones David Sanger is writing about. It's the turf war between delivery app companies, the delivery workers, and the restaurants that deliver through them in New York City. There was recently a wage increase law that took effect for the delivery workers, some of you know, but if you're the customer in this equation, maybe you've noticed that on some of the apps, it's becoming harder to tip. You have to look harder to find the tipping buttons, or the suggested tipping percentages have gone down, or you can only tip after delivery, not when you order, which makes tipping at all less likely. Delivery worker advocates say it's a form of retaliation for the higher wage law. The apps claim the law is causing restaurants to lose money and lay off employees. We'll get several views and take your calls. City Council member Sean Abreu is the sponsor of a bill to require the tipping be clear and easily seen at the point of checkout. He's also proposing, if I'm reading this right, a required minimum tip of 10%. New York City Councilmember Sean Abreu joins us now. His Manhattan district runs from the Upper West Side to Washington Heights. Councilmember, welcome.
Hey, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Always good to have you on. And also with us, Lahia Hualpa, Executive Director of the Workers' Justice Project, which represents delivery workers. Ms. Hualpa, welcome back to WNYC.
Yeah, thank you for having me as well.
And we will also hear in a few minutes, folks, from a restaurant owner who was referred to us by DoorDash, who says his Queens-based business is being badly hurt by the new wage standards. Councilmember, would you remind us first about the recent wage hike law? I read that it brought the required wage to just under $20 an hour. Tell me if that's right, and what exactly changed and when.
So when the minimum wage went into effect, the apps retaliated by removing the tipping option at checkout. And just to make very clear, deliveristas make $20 an hour for active time worked. That's the moment during which the order is picked up from the restaurant and the moment that's delivered to someone's door. That's the only time a deliverista is making minimum wage. The time that they spent waiting for an order, which is referred to as call time, those resources get pulled among all deliveristas, but it's never to the amount, or I wouldn't want to say never, but it's almost never at the amount of a minimum wage. So on balance, deliveristas are actually not making a minimum wage an hour, only when that delivery is being made.
Can I jump in on that detail, Ms. Hualpa? How do the restaurants or the apps keep track of the exact minutes when a delivery worker is moving from the restaurant to somebody's home? I mean, are they clocking in and out at that granular level in some way?
Yeah, absolutely. What we have seen is the apps continue to be less transparent with workers, but also forcing workers to lose their flexibility by moving into a scheduling system, which is another tactic to limit the flexibility of workers who continue to be independent contractors and food delivery companies who continue to be less transparent about how workers are scheduling hours, but also how workers are being paid for the time that they're actively working.
But I'm curious, I'm sure listeners are curious, just how that works. Does a delivery worker at the point when they leave the restaurant click a button on an app to say, I'm on the clock now because I'm in transit or something like that?
Yeah, what we're seeing app delivery companies do is forcing workers to a scheduling system where workers are forced to schedule X number of hours without guarantee of actual work. So what we're seeing is app delivery companies being less transparent, forcing workers into scheduling systems, tracking workers where they are, but at the same time, limiting workers' flexibility, which directly impacts the income of app delivery companies, app delivery workers.
And Councilmember Abreu, where does the tipping come in?
So the tipping comes in terms of a broader equity issue. We believe very strongly that consumers should be able to tip how much they want and as ever frequently as they want. So that's why we have two bills, right? One bill would establish tipping at checkout and not tipping. That option will no longer, our goal is so that tipping option will no longer be available after the delivery is ordered, right? no one is going to tip once their food has arrived, once their apps are closed, or once they are chowing down on their food.
I'm going to ask you a pushback question about that that we're already getting a text message about from a listener, but we'll hold that for a second. Keep going with your answer.
And anyone who has ordered on these apps can tell you that they'll reopen the apps weeks later to order again, only to see the tip menu from their order weeks ago. So what apps like DoorDash and Uber has done is to disincentivize and discourage tipping, you know, altogether.
How?
By people are more inclined to tip at checkout than they are inclined to tip after
the wage increase took effect that they moved tipping from point of checkout to after delivery?
That's correct. In fact, Grubhub still has it at checkout. But DoorDash and Uber, they removed it from checkout. And it's hurting deliveristas who depend on this for their livelihoods. With respect to the second bill, I would also like to say is a suggested minimum donation of 10%.
It's not required. Okay, I've seen it reported in the press as required. So I'm glad you're clearing that up.
Yeah, it's required that the option be presented, but consumers are not mandated to tip at all.
Thank you for clearing that up. So, Ms. Walpa, why would the app companies like DoorDash or Uber benefit from the drivers getting fewer tips? Don't the company's profits only come from a percentage of the base order?
So it is important to understand here, part of the norm before minimum wage law implementation, the big delivery companies didn't have an issue about having the tipping option when you started to order the food. And removing the tipping really started right after minimum wage implementation as a way to continue to discourage consumers to tip, but also as a tactic to intentionally hurt workers, because now the companies have to pay the active time, which is meaning the time that most workers are actually working.
But is there any financial benefit to the apps, to DoorDash and Uber in particular? I think those are the two you're singling out. Delivery workers getting lower tips?
Of course. One of the things is the adding a tipping option doesn't impact financially, nor to the business, nor to the company. I think let's start there. And then tipping really is, as it was mentioned by the council member, it's a voluntary contribution of the consumer and it actually increases worker satisfaction and ability and recognition for the work that they do in the city of New York. It has been part of the norm in the industry for many years now. And what we want to make sure is we continue with that tradition that has been part of New York City's fabric. Tipping, we tip at the restaurants, we tip in many places. So tipping to delivery workers should be part of the norm as the same in other industries. And it should be a way to continue to recognize the labor of workers who do essential work for the city of New York.
So listeners, help us report this story, and you can share your opinions too. And if you are in any role in the delivery economy, tell us your story. Are you a delivery worker listening right now? What's been happening since your official minimum wage went up? Have your tips gone down? Are you making more money or the same or less than before? How do you get paid for your time? 212-433-WNYC. If you're a customer who orders for delivery, is your ordering behavior or your tipping behavior changing since the minimum wage went up? Would you even know that happened if I didn't say it, that the minimum wage went up? Have you noticed that it's become more inconvenient to tip on any of the apps in particular, or that it's only available after delivery, whereas it used to be at the point of checkout as well? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or if you're a restaurant owner, and we're going to hear from one in a minute, or an employee, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So Councilmember Breo, here's a pushback question, and I'm expanding on a comment from a listener via text message. One could argue that tipping really only belongs at the point after service is delivered. Lahuia just mentioned restaurants. Well, you don't tip your server in a restaurant when they take your order at your table, only after the meal when the customer decides how much of a tip they deserve or want to give. When you take an Uber, after the ride is completed, not before, the app asks you to rate the driver 1 to 5 and determine your tip. So why shouldn't tipping delivery workers be done in the traditional way after the service is performed and with some variation depending on, well, the variation is still there depending on the quality of the service, but after the service is performed?
I have no reason to believe that a deliverista will not do its job. I can count on my hand after hundreds of deliveries how many times an order has never been delivered to my house. I mean, maybe twice or three times. I know deliveristas are going to make the orders to my apartment. Deliveristas would even drive 3 miles to bring someone a French toast, right? I don't need to have it after the service has been delivered. We know deliveristas are going to take their food to your door under the most severe conditions. So for me, it doesn't really make a difference. And I think for a lot of consumers, it really doesn't make a difference.
Ms. Wapa, do you want to get in on that? Do you want to expand on that answer at all, add to it?
Well, I think the unique difference between other workers is that deliveristas are not workers. They're considered independent contractors. Let's start there. And what that means for a deliverista is that the current minimum pay, for the most part, most only covers from the time that they're actively working. So that means that if a worker is not guaranteed and is not doing orders, especially now that the low season is coming, which is the summer, most workers depend on tipping to being able to complement and make a living wage. And then the second I would say, tipping also kind of allows deliveristas to make a financial decision whether it is worth to travel 3-4 miles to make that delivery. The second thing is, when a deliverista accepts your order, for most of the time, it's guaranteed and by the company's rule, it's kind of like deliveristas are mandated to make that delivery. And the other one is part of the tradition to guarantee and ensure that workers are recognized, and the best way to recognize workers is by tipping. It's part of New York City's tradition.
Let's take one phone call before we bring in a restaurant owner from Queens who's going to give us a whole other story than we've been hearing from you, or a whole other argument. Chris in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good morning, Brian. It's Chris Carthy from Armonk. You know, I've been thinking about this tipping model for quite a bit. I go into my local coffee shop in the morning, for example, and there's a tip option. You know, the problem with tipping is that it's discretionary. Some people are tipping, some people aren't. And the wage rate fluctuates for the barista or for the delivery guy. I don't understand why the model isn't different. You implement a service fee. Essentially, this is a service rendered. There is a contractual agreement to pay for that service, and that money then is used to pay a livable wage.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Chris. And Ms. Wapa, for you representing delivery workers, I realize this would take an even bigger change than the council member's bill is proposing, but would you prefer, in theory, to go to a no tipping but a delivery fee that gets paid to the delivery worker system? I know they debate this in restaurants too, right? Is it better to move? Some restaurants are experimenting with no tipping, but a service charge that's transparent. Would you like that?
We all want more transparency, and let's have a bigger conversation about what we're dealing with. We're dealing with multi-billion-dollar corporations who charges a fee to the restaurant, who charges a fee to the consumer, and who gets to keep that fee? For the most part, the companies. What we're asking here and what we have been fighting is with the minimum pay transparency is ensuring workers get the ability to earn a living wage. And we did that by guaranteeing this year, 1956. But the conversation about tipping is that 1956 is not enough in the city of New York, not enough for independent contractors who have a high operating cost, and not enough workers who are not guaranteed enough hours, and workers who are not entirely guaranteed all connected time. So we have workers who might be connected 5-6 hours, but necessarily that doesn't mean that that worker will be paid for those 5-6 hours. So tipping allows to complement the worker's income where they don't have enough work, or when they're not being paid for all the out connected time as well. So what we're asking here for the city of New York is let's bring more pay transparency. Let's for the companies to disclose the tipping, to make it available and optional to consumers at the end of the day, consumers' choice to tip or not. Let's make that option available to consumers, and let's make them decide whether they want to tip.
Also with us now is a restaurant owner from Queens who DoorDash arranged for us to speak to represent restaurant owners and by extension the apps. Shuai Zhang owns Pup Price, a modern Chinese takeout restaurant that started with one location in Kew Gardens in 2020, has since expanded to 3 spots across Brooklyn and Queens, and was also selected this year as a vendor for the Citi Field Taste of Queens lineup, as it's called, for the Mets 2024 season. Shuai, thanks very much for joining us. I'll be going to a game in a few weeks, and I'll look for your food at Citi Field. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Are you seeing an impact on your business from the new minimum wage for delivery workers?
Oh, yeah. We had 3 restaurants last year. And since September, our delivery revenue has down more than 50%. And we had to shut down 2 other locations. We were having a team of 25, including our own delivery drivers, a team of 25 employees, and then now we have only 4 left.
We have a number of people calling or texting to ask this question, and since you just kind of brought up that topic, I'm going to go right there first. Listener writes, what is the advantage of restaurants joining a delivery app? We order only from restaurants that hire their own delivery personnel so that we know that the delivery person actually receives the tip. I think, Shuai, I heard you just say that you used to hire your own delivery people. Why don't you do that? Why don't a lot of restaurants do that rather than use the apps?
Actually, we had our own delivery drivers using the app. The third-party delivery apps provide that option that we could use our own delivery drivers. But I see this service, this technology, the third-party delivery app, is a great way to manage the entire delivery process. And also it's a great tool for us to reach out to our customers.
Explain from your perspective why this increase to $20 an hour for delivery workers would have had such a deleterious effect on your business. A lot of listeners might say, well, $20 an hour isn't that much, and it's not that much more than they were making before. How could it be that it's cost you 50% of your delivery business or to close some of your locations?
I think it's a 1-2 punch. This is a really bad timing to implement such change because the overall economy is also bad at this time. If they implement this change during 2022 or maybe 2021 when the delivery service was hottest, it wouldn't be this bad. But this is just one part of the problem. Another big part of the problem is this new bill the city presented is not really built for the delivery business model because I give you an example. $20, my own delivery workers, they were making more than $20 an hour on average, including tips on daily basis. It's because they know how to deliver efficiently. and they treat this business as their own business. So they grab the food, they make sure their customer is happy so they can get more tips in return. They never think about, you know, counting their time when they do delivery. They always try their best to deliver as fast as possible. But right now, since they are paid hourly, they are paid on clock, that means the speed of the delivery is not their first priority anymore, because they come here to, they want to make money.
Explain that one? And you know, the DoorDash publicist who referred us to you said something similar. Because of the changes to how workers are compensated, you're having trouble getting delivery workers to take orders due to a lack of incentive, the publicist said. And I don't understand that one. Wouldn't a higher wage for the time that they're actually in transit give them more incentive to work, to take more orders?
Only when they start the process, they have the incentive. But now they are trying to get more orders done in a short period of time. Customers pay more fees, so most of the customers, they cut down their tips anymore. They don't pay tips anymore, or they cut down their tips to maybe a dollar back. We have seen that.
So maybe it's in your interest, too, for the tips to be maximized under the bill that the council member is proposing, or the availability of tipping to be maximized. Do you agree or disagree?
Actually, I don't want to comment on that because I'm not a policy maker. I don't know. I agree with the city, what they're trying to do. They want to provide a better life for the delivery drivers. There are many other ways, but I'm speaking the fact that the delivery, we're seeing less delivery orders. Customers are paying more money for delivery food, and we're seeing less delivery drivers coming here to pick up the food. Some of the food got stayed in restaurant with for a delivery driver for 20, 30 minutes, and the food will be cold once it's delivered to the customer, and the customer obviously not going to be happy, and they'll pay even less tips.
The price went up. Well, how much do you say you've had to raise prices for the dishes at your restaurant that are being delivered that you'd say is because of the delivery workers now making $20 an hour? How much have you had to raise prices?
We lowered our price to combat this. If we increase our price, we are pushing even more customers away from us, from ordering from us. The fact is, two of my workers right now working in my restaurant as a cook, they were our delivery drivers, and they all say that they're making less money per day than before.
Councilmember Abreu, would you like to ask our guest, the restaurant owner from Queens, Shui Zhang, any question?
Sure. I mean, I'm curious to know whether or not he thinks that apps are squeezing out restaurants, because it seems as though that apps can get up to 20% per order. Is there room here for the apps to get less of a share here in order to make it easier on their business?
That would be great, but we have built a system for this 20%. I think there's a gap right now in the city since COVID, and it works for us because we especially have this delivery system built for that 20%, and we can still make around 10% of profit after all. And I believe not only they take 20% cut, but they save us a lot of management labor, and also they help us with marketing. And for my first location, we are in a stream mall that during COVID, there's no office anymore in the building. And even right now, only 30% of office operational. in the building. So we don't have any food traffic in that location anymore. Without delivery platform, without attracting customers further away from the location, we wouldn't have this business at all.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, my other question is, my understanding is that there has been a decline in orders because we have been coming out of the pandemic. Have you seen a downward trends of orders coming your way before minimum wage came into effect?
No. It starts, I think last year, summertime was slow because of the summer. Every summer is slow for us. And September, since everybody come back to work, the students come back to school, we see a big increase during September. And October is where we hit by the increase. And compared to the year before, we lost more than 50% of the delivery sales.
Ms. Walpa, do you want to engage at all with Schwai? I mean, we have two presumably sympathetic populations here, the delivery workers and small restaurant owners like him.
Yeah, I think, you know, I just wanted to, first of all, appreciate his own experience sharing, because at the end of the day, deliveristas in restaurants, you know, are actually in the business to support each other. Something that I want to ask him is about, would it, if there is a FICA, if they feel that the delivery fees have, there is delivery fees charged by the companies have increased because of the minimum pay. Has he seen that?
Chui, you get the question?
I'm sorry, I lost a little bit. What was the question? Can you please?
If you feel that the delivery companies are charging you more fees for the service they provide you because of the minimum pay increase.
And I do have a text from a listener here, too, that says, as someone who orders maybe once a week, I've noticed a continual increase in fees, and that's separate from the tipping. But Schwai, go ahead.
I don't think a delivery platform charges us more money, more fees. They charge they pass the fees to customers.
Right.
They charge more fees from the customer, but we lost customer because they don't have money, extra money to spend on delivery. Delivery has become a luxury for them.
Would you rather see the apps disappear as a restaurant owner?
Before I opened my restaurant, early in my career, in my restaurant career, I actually managed my own delivery team for a local Chinese restaurant. We were doing everything on our own. And I can tell you that the management for that aspect is really, really difficult. And there are a lot of liabilities involved. I don't want to go back to that age. I think there has to be a way that we can utilize technology to make the process smoother and better.
So they are performing a service for your restaurant. Shuai Zhang owns, tell me if I say it right, Pop Rice?
Yeah.
A modern Chinese takeout restaurant that started in Kew Gardens. You're still in Kew Gardens?
Yeah, this is our first location and right now our only location.
And if I go to a Mets game, where can I find you at Citi Field?
We are next to the Shake Shack. You can see a taste of Queens Pop Rice.
Everybody knows where the Shake Shack is. Thank you for joining us. And
thank you.
Before we flip topics here, any I don't know, Councilman, any new common ground that might emerge out of that that's in everybody's interest?
Not really. I don't think we should be scapegoating deliveristas to begin with. If consumers are seeing this as an increased cost on ordering food, consumers have the option to not tip at all. And if it's within your means to tip, even after realizing what the cost of food is, then by any, you know, by any means, you can still tip. I also want to make clear again that the apps have the power here, and restaurants as well. The apps are squeezing our restaurants, and they have it within their powers to make sure that that cap, they're not charging restaurants up to the 20% cap to make it easier on our restaurants. Also, when the minimum wage went into effect, there were fees that were passed on to customers. So the customers are paying for the minimum wage. So how is it that the minimum wage is impacting restaurants? It just doesn't make any sense. Customers are the ones bearing the cost for that. And if customers want to, and consumers want to bear the cost for tipping, we want to make that option available to them. I also want to make clear that deliveristas aren't making the minimum wage for every time that they're working. If it's active time worked, yes, they get minimum wage from the moment they drop off the delivery. Sorry, from the moment they pick up the delivery to the moment they drop it off. But the time that they spend waiting to get orders, that's not getting minimum wage. Those are resources that are being pulled among all deliveristas for call time. And we want transparency. Why is it that some deliveristas are making more and others making less? That goes back to our transparency issues that we also are working on in the city council.
Lahuia Hualpa, I want to thank you, Executive Director of the Workers' Justice Project, which represents delivery workers. Thank you very much for joining us. Good to have you on again.
Thank you.
And listeners, we're going to continue with Councilmember Abreu briefly on another topic when we come back after a break. This one's going to be more universally popular, I think. Birth control for rats, which he's also proposing in a new bill in City Council. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Few more minutes with New York City Council Member Sean Abreu from Upper Manhattan, from Washington Heights down to the Upper West Side, and on another bill you're working on about the rat population in the city. Is this your idea about feeding the rats tasty forms of birth control that work on both male and female rats?
It's certainly not my idea to invent birth control for rats, but it's certainly our idea to make sure that we establish a pilot program through legislation. We're really excited about the prospects. We know that two rats in a given year can reproduce 15,000 descendants. And so we can't get our way out of this by just killing rats. We gotta get to it at the source, Brian.
Why does this need to be a city council bill? Can't Mayor Adams' rat czar just decide to do it?
The council's job is to legislate. The mayor's job is to execute. There's nothing stopping the mayor from establishing a birth control program for rodents. But we're taking the initiative at the council through legislation.
And here is, I think, a constituent in your district who has a reaction to this. Leslie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Leslie.
Thank you. Councilman Abreu, I applaud what you're doing about the rats. I think it's absolutely fabulous. I have been in touch with people in your office who have been most attentive about a major problem on the Upper West Side at West 100th Street between Amsterdam and Columbus Avenues, where there is a 24th police precinct and a fire company 76 ladder 22.
Leslie, I know you've been a caller on this issue before, and you know I used to live around there and we've talked, but I thought you were calling about the rats today.
I am calling about the rats. It's rats infested because you can't clean the garbage. It's very important that he be able to feed the rats birth control. But in addition, if you leave the garbage all over the street because you can't clean the street, you're just welcoming the rats to have food to eat.
So you're saying all the parking and double parking by the police and fire stations are impeding sanitation. Is that what you're saying?
Without a question, you cannot ever get this street cleaned. It is impossible. I have transportation. I have worked with the community relations people at both the police and the fire. In addition, now on Columbus Avenue from 97th to 100th Street, we have several big box stores where, although their garbage is picked up, their platforms where they receive the garbage are never swept out. So big garbage, but they never clean the floor.
Leslie, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you for drawing the council members' attention to that block. Lorraine in Westchester has a different take on birth control for rats, maybe a side effect. Is that right, Lorraine?
That's correct. Thank you, Brian. I'm a licensed wildlife rehabilitator with the Center for Wildlife, and I handle birds of prey, amongst other wildlife. And a couple of at least two times a year, I receive birds of prey, hawks, owls, etc., that have secondary poisoning from the rat, because rats are slowed down. They're not killed immediately, because that protects, you know, other people. So it takes a couple of days. And during that time, when they're slowed down, they're easy prey for the birds of prey. And poisoning is not the answer. I think birth control certainly is. Or you had a gentleman on a few months ago that talked about CO2.
Oh, so you're for the birth control because that means less rat poison. Am I understanding you correctly?
That's right. It means a smaller population and they wouldn't have to use as much poison.
Right. Very good. Thank you.
I can
Thank
respond you. To that, Brian.
Councilman, go ahead.
I mean, first of all, I'm excited that folks are excited about birth control for rats. And, you know, one of the main reasons we're also doing it, too, is that we realize that rodenticide just doesn't work. Right. The anticoagulants that are within rodenticide, rats have grown resistant towards it. And we know as well the impact that rodenticide can have and it can have on not only on birds of prey, but also domestic animals like dogs. There was a case in Washington Heights where a dog died from rodenticide. Yeah. So it's an overall win at getting at the source of the problem, but also when you think about wildlife and domestic animals.
But we are getting texts about what I thought the caller in Westchester was going to say. This text says, all I want to know is, just like the rat poison passed through to kill Flacco, what's to stop birth control from passing through to birds of prey?
Sorry, what's the question?
The question is, what's to stop the birth control from passing through to owls and other birds of prey if they eat the rats that have taken birth control?
Yeah, so this has non-toxic substances. This will have no problem at all in terms of the impact it would have on passing it on. And is also, so that's my answer to that.
Non-toxic, but also it wouldn't cause the birds to be impaired from reproducing, you're saying?
Yes.
And on the effectiveness, a New York Times article notes that several generations of rat birth control dating all the way back to Governor Nelson Rockefeller's day have been tried and have failed. Why would this be any better?
Well, let me tell you how we have been changing our practices in terms of waste management. And that has a lot to do with why I think this will be effective. So there have been failed experiments for a very long time on birth control because rats have had extreme access to piles of trash that have been sitting out on the street. Remember, rats only need 1 ounce of food to survive any given day. But now that we're containerizing our trash, rats are more likely to eat the actual contraceptive. It's basically a sweet, salty, peanut buttery substance in a solid pellet form that rats would be attracted to. And that's why we would be introducing this rat birth control within the rat mitigation zone and within the areas where trash is containerized. Like in my district, we have containerization pilot and there's no bags of trash out on the street. So it increases the likelihood that rats will be eating the contraceptive, and that's going to make a big difference.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that too, real quick, because we're almost out of time. Can you see a measurable difference in the rat population from your district having the containerization experiment rather than plastic bags?
Off the bat, Brian, there has been a 68% reduction in the first 3 months in rat sightings. So there has gone 311 complaints have gone down by 68%. And if you walk through West Harlem, it feels different. Everybody's taking pride in their neighborhood. Everybody is dropping off their trash on their way to work or after they get back from work. It's become a norm and a way of life even.
Last question on the birth control. Can you trust the male rats to actually take the birth control when they say they are? No, I'm just kidding. We will leave it there with New York City Council member Sean Abreu. We've talked about his bill on tipping. We've talked about his bill on birth control for rats. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. George Takei is with us now. George Takei, you don't have to be a Star Trek super fan to appreciate his work and his activism. He has a new book that provides a personal account of a dark chapter in American history. Takei was a four-year-old California kid when the Imperial Japanese Navy Air Service struck Pearl Harbor. Just a couple of months later, his family and many thousands of other Americans of Japanese descent were forcibly sent to incarceration camps. You may be more familiar with the term internment camp, but the preferred term is incarceration camp. Takei's new book, My Lost Freedom, A Japanese-American World War II Story, is also his debut picture book, and it tells this story in a manner that is appropriate for readers ages 6 through 9. So, George Takei, welcome to WNYC today. So great to have you on with us.
Good morning. Thank you very much. It's great to be on with you.
The book's title, My Lost Freedom, powerful and evocative phrase, obviously. Tell us more what happened to you.
Well, this is a children's picture book, so we tell the story with lovely pictures. Really a gifted artist, Michelle Lee, who did the drawings. And on the cover, you'll see me as a five-year-old kid with a shaggy black stray dog that we found behind the mess hall in the Arkansas camp that we were in. And he became Henry, my brother, a year younger. He was four. I was five. Our pet that made life behind barbed wire fences as livable and fun as possible. So this is the story of how my parents dealt with the challenges of imprisonment and injustice with their example, how they showed resilience and creativity, and protected the three children. Our baby sister was an infant, and we survived that terrible experience as best as we could.
And one of the most striking aspects of the book, I think, is the way it captures the emotional and psychological impact of the incarceration on you and your family. Can you share any specific memories or moments that were particularly difficult to revisit and translate into a story that is for 6-year-olds to 9-year-olds?
Well, the first experience was the most vivid. This was a morning in May, early May in 1942. My father came rushing into the bedroom that I shared with my brother, Henry, and dressed us hurriedly and asked us to wait in the living room while our parents did some packing back in their bedroom. Our baby sister was in a cradle in their bedroom, and there's nothing to do in the living room, so Henry and I were standing by the front window just gazing out, and suddenly we saw two soldiers marching up our driveway, carrying rifles with shiny bayonets on them. They stomped up the porch and with their fists began banging on the door. My father came rushing out from his bedroom and answered the door, and one of the soldiers pointed his bayonet at our father.
Whoa.
Henry and I were petrified, and the other soldier said, "Get your family out of this house." And my father said, "Can I have 10 minutes?" And they gave us that. My father came out carrying two heavy suitcases, and we followed him out onto the driveway, and we stood there waiting for our mother. The other soldier escorted my mother out, and when she came out the front door, she had our baby sister in one arm, a huge duffel bag, heavy-looking duffel bag, in the other, and tears were streaming down her cheeks. That was the way the whole internment went down on us. But that heavy duffel bag became a very special bag for us because it looked very heavy, and indeed it was. When we were put on a train and on a journey of 3 days and two nights across the country, across the southwestern desert to the swamps of Arkansas, she pulled out during that trip, out of that heavy bag, picture books, candy, pops, not soda pops, but lollipops, and animal cracker boxes, and all these goodies. And because it was heavy, we thought that it was really laden down with a lot of goodies for us. But when we arrived at the Arkansas camp, barbed wires, black tar paper barracks, and there were masses of other Japanese people that were already brought there, we were taken to our assigned unit, of one of those black tar paper barracks. And when the guards were gone, my mother said, "I will show you something," and opened up that wonderful bag, that magical bag that produced so much tasty and fun goodies out of that. She pulled out a portable sewing machine. That was contraband because all things sharp or had points on them were forbidden. She marched past all those armed guards carrying that contraband, forbidden thing, and brought that sewing machine with her. And she told our father, "The children will be needing clothes. They're going to be growing." So she had a practical thought in mind, but also the guts to march past those guards carrying that contraband bag.
What a mom. She brings the lollipops. She brings the forbidden sewing machine so she could continue to make you clothing. And listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is none other than George Takei, who is best known for his role as Mr. Sulu on Star Trek Once Upon a Time, but has done a lot of activism in the years since and has a new children's book called My Lost Freedom, A Japanese-American World War II Story. As you've been hearing, it is his own family story. And George, already, even before I give out the phone number, there are people calling in who want to talk to you, and it's 212-433-WNYC, for those of you who don't have it on your speed dial, 212-433-9692. And I'm going to go to David in Brooklyn first, George, because you were just telling this traumatic story of your family being moved from your home in California when you were 4 years old, 5 years old, to an incarceration camp for Japanese Americans in Arkansas. And David in Brooklyn says he once met you in Arkansas.
Oh, really?
At a Star Trek convention. David, you're on WNYC with George Takei. Hello.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Just great. Good to hear
George.
Your voice.
I, I don't know if there's any way that you remember me, but this was in Hot Springs in Arkansas, and you were at a Star Trek convention.
Yes.
And I was working for a newspaper then, and I interviewed you, and I remember I led off the story with that this was your second visit to Arkansas, because the first one was in the camp.
Yes.
And I don't know if you remember that or not, but I do. And I'm wondering if you have any fears that this sort of thing could happen again in America.
You know, I am very fearful. The reason why I tell this story in book form, and I've talked about it on radio and television, is because there's a lesson to be learned from that chapter of American history. And because I don't think our country has learned that lesson, we are living through that kind of wild and irrational hysteria now. And it is a very concerning and, to me, a little frightening time that we're going through this presidential election year. That's why I have written this book, My Lost Freedom, to reach the parents and for them to read to their little ones about what happened over 82 years ago. So there's a lesson to be learned, and I hope people rush out and parents rush out to buy My Lost Freedom so that they can inform and introduce their little ones about what happened way back then when I was a boy. And I hope certainly the children will be introduced to that story, but the parents do some more reading on it to try to prevent that kind of thing from happening again.
And people can not only rush out and buy your book, but they can rush out and see you tonight in Manhattan. I'm throwing this in now to make sure I don't forget it at the end of the segment. Tonight at Symphony Space in Manhattan on the Upper West Side at 8 o'clock. You're doing a live appearance tonight?
Yes. I'll be doing another TV show. And then tonight, I'm going to be in conversation with B.D. Wong, also an actor, who played my son in an episode of Black Magic many, many decades ago. And he's a grown-up now, and I have grown to be his parent. And we're going to reminisce about old times, and I might share a little bit about my childhood with him at Symphony Hall, or Symphony Space, here in Manhattan.
Kim in Los Angeles. You're on WNYC with George Takei. Hello, Kim.
Yes, hello. I'm a professor at Loyola Marymount University out here and teaching some of the grandchildren, actually, of people who were in the incarceration camps. Now, my question is that as you have published this book and tell your story, do you meet the same kind of resistance that people who are telling stories of the enslavement of African Americans are meeting, you know, so in states where it's, you know, the books are banned and, you know, you can't talk about diversity and equity and inclusion. So are you meeting that same kind of resistance, or have you been hearing about that as you've been telling the stories of these camps?
There has been some resistance, but what's more common and concerning for me is that so many Americans don't know this chapter of American history. And as George Santayana said, those who can't remember the past are doomed to repeat it. And there's so much truth in Santayana's wisdom, because it is happening again. And the most concerning thing for me is that so many younger Japanese Americans tell me that they know very little about their own family history, because, as they say, the victims often take on the shame of what they went through, when the shame really belongs to the government. Hmm. They made a terrible mistake and imprisoned innocent people who had nothing to do with Pearl Harbor in these barbaric barbed wire prison camps. And because the people that experienced that history didn't talk about it because they felt shame, their children and their grandchildren know very little about their own family history. So I feel my mission is not just my mission to inform Americans of American history, but also of my fellow Japanese Americans, many of whom don't know their own family history.
And here's one of your fellow Japanese Americans calling in now, Kazuko in Westchester. You're on WNYC with George Takei. Hello, Kazuko.
Hi, I want to say I'm so grateful for this program. My mother's family was incarcerated. They lived in California.
Yes.
And my grandfather had designed the irrigation system for all the farmers. And
where
the community
were they? Where in California were they, your grandfather?
In the Los Angeles area.
Ah, that's my hometown, mm-hmm. Los Angeles. My father's hometown was San Francisco, and my mother was born in Sacramento.
Yeah, and they were incarcerated exactly the same way you described your family. And they were taken to the deserts of Wyoming. So that incarceration camp was called Heart Mountain.
Heart Mountain, yes.
Yeah, and none of the community knew what was there. They were originally sent to Santa Ana horse.
Santa Anita.
Horse stalls.
The horse stables Santa were called Anita. Santa Anita. Yeah. We were there too.
Right, Santa Anita. That's correct. Yes. Yeah. So the family of five lived in a horse stall for a few days, and then they
actually
woke up
we were there in the horse stalls for over 4 months.
In
it
the
wasn't
horse stalls.
Just a few days
with horses.
Right.
No. But the presence of the horses were intense. The stench of horse manure and the insects skittering around on the ground and flies buzzing in the air. I'm sure that it was more than a few days for your grandparents.
Right.
Kazuko, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you very much. The word, for people who are wondering, who've heard it through their lives as internment camps, but the preferred term now is incarceration camps. What's the difference? What's implied there?
Well, words have meaning. When we were first driven out of our home at gunpoint, they used terms like relocation center or a wartime village, very fuzzy words, a euphemism that really were not descriptive of the truth of the camps. Then the term internment camp came up, and that too is not as soft, but nevertheless, it really isn't descriptive of what we were incarcerated in. And historians came up with the term concentration camp. And there was a reaction from the Jewish community who felt that that was their ancestral experience. But I try to explain to them dictionary definition of concentration camp is concentrating people of a common faith or history or religion or political circumstance. That's what we were. We were concentrated together behind these barbed wire fences because of politics. Mm-hmm. We had nothing to do with Pearl Harbor, but we looked exactly like the people who bombed Pearl Harbor. We were American citizens, and yet that was erased by the hysteria of the time and the racism of that time. But because of vagueness of people's understanding of concentration camp, we use incarceration camp now.
One more call. Andrew in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with George Takei. Hello, Andrew.
Hi. I'm a huge fan, and I'm very excited to read your book with my son, who's sitting with me, if he makes a little noise. He gets a little older. But there are, you know, so many episodes of Star Trek that deal with the consequences of war and its impact on civilians. And I was curious if you ever, you know, spoke to writers of the various shows about your experience, and if there are any episodes that particularly resonated with your personal experience as a child.
Well, Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, was very familiar with that story. And he was, I think, a visionary and a philosopher. He wanted to deal with those stories, but television is an advertising medium. And if you are that specific, they wouldn't put this series on television. So what Gene Roddenberry did was speak metaphorically and tell the story set in the future. And so there we were on the Starship Enterprise, which has a rounded body to it. And that's a metaphor for Starship Earth. And Gene Roddenberry said that the strength of this starship lay in its diversity coming together. People of different backgrounds, different histories, different faiths, different experiences, coming together, sharing their various viewpoints and knowledge, and working together as a team. And that's the strength of this starship. But also that diversity makes life together that much more engaging and interesting. And so every episode has that message of we need to work together and recognize that our real strength comes from each other. A few episodes dealt more specifically with the racial prejudice idea. Let this be your own. Let this be your last battlefield, I think was the title of the episode, where there were two alien species. One alien species was white on the right side and black on the left side. And the other alien species was black on the right side and white on the left side. And they couldn't get along with each other.
I remember that episode. It made its point very well.
Yes.
So in our last minute, since the book is for 6 to 9-year-olds and picking up on that last question in your last answer, do you have any advice to offer to young readers who may be grappling with any issues of identity, belonging, and the legacy of historical injustice? Can My Lost Freedom, your book, serve as a source of inspiration and empowerment in a particular way?
I think so. The story is about that very subject and told from the vantage point of me as a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old. And there the cover has me with the black shaggy dog, a stray dog that we found sniffing around behind the mess hall kitchen. And we had, adopted that dog, and that dog made life in behind barbed wire a fun, engaging, one with a loyal dog that walked us to our schoolroom in the morning and patiently waited for us until we were dismissed from school and played with us the rest of the day. So, you know, this book talks about finding joy in harsh circumstances and creating our own happiness. That's what resilience means. And sure. That's what our parents gave us to survive, and now to write books about it and share that experience and the lesson from that experience with all of us today.
Beautifully said. George Takei, his new book out today is My Lost Freedom, a Japanese-American World War II story. And again, he's got a live event in Manhattan at Symphony Space, 95th and Broadway, tonight at 8 o'clock. Thank you so much for making this one of your stops. It was an honor.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed chatting with your listeners.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.